Okay, well, thanks a lot for the invitation to come here. I've never been to Perimeter before, so it's been a fun experience. As you can tell, I'm going to give a board talk, which means this is not an applied talk. So I'm a mathematician by training. I always did mathematical physics growing up with an emphasis on the math and a reverence for the physics. That's how I kind of pitch it. And I started using these kind of techniques from statistical and mathematical physics to try to understand how neural networks work. Okay, so I'm going to try to present something about exactly solvable models of learning with neural networks. And everything I present is based on two papers, one that's out and one which will be out any day now, with a really excellent PhD student from MIT called Alexander Zlokapa. Okay, he does quantum computation mainly, but he's sort of moonlighting as a machine learning person. Okay, so I don't assume everyone's an expert in deep learning theory, so I'm going to try to keep the talk self-contained, but I'm going to try to move at a pace that helps me to get to stating some new results. So we'll see how that goes. Okay, so before I try to get into the actual problem I'm trying to solve, let me just give you a little bit of like an overview for the kinds of questions I'm interested in. Okay, so typically for me in machine learning, there are like three kinds of inputs that you get. Okay, so the first thing you get is some data. And for me, okay, this is an excuse also to tell you my notation. Data is a data set, so I'll call it script D. And it's a bunch of inputs, which I'll call x mu, and some outputs y mu. And my number of training data points I call capital P in the tradition of kind of spin glasses or whatever you want. Okay, so these inputs x mu are going to be an Rn0 for me, and the outputs will be scalars. So I'm going to try to learn the function that generated these secret outputs given the inputs. That's going to be the goal of my setting. And so to do that, I introduce a model, right? And my model is going to be a kind of vanilla deep neural network. So the model is going to be like this. I'll call it f of x and theta. So x is the input and theta is the parameters. And it's going to look like this. So it's going to be capital L is the number of hidden layers in my model. And let me write the formula, and then I'll explain what I mean, or maybe you already know. OK, so you start with an input x, and then you transform it through capital L hidden layers, where you hit it by a matrix. And then to each component, you apply the same fixed nonlinear function sigma. And then the output of my network is just obtained by a kind of linear readout from the last hidden layer. OK, so my notation is that the WLs are NL by NL minus 1 dimensional matrices. So these capital L Ns are usually called the widths of the network. And capital L is usually called the depth of the network. And when people say deep learning, they mean L is fairly big. That's kind of what deep actually means. OK, very good. And then the last thing you need to actually do some kind of machine learning is you need a learning rule. How are you actually going to do your optimization over your parameters? OK, so for the moment, let me just denote it generally by script A. So a learning rule does what? It takes in a data set and a model, and it returns a setting of trainable parameters, which I'll call theta learned. Right? And then you fix these parameters, and then you plug in new x's, and you make predictions. That's pretty much how machine learning works. OK, so the kind of questions that I'm broadly interested in, and I'm not the only one, kind of go like this. Let me give you a couple of questions that I think are prototypical. So the first question is, these are models that have many large parameters in them. Okay, and I grew up doing asymptotics, so the more large parameters, the better from my point of view. And I'd like to understand what happens to learning when all the large parameters are potentially large. Okay, so this is the analysis of the learning algorithm when the number of data points and the hidden layer widths and the depth and whatever else you like can be very large. Okay, I didn't phrase it in the form of a question, but I hope you'll forgive me. Okay, so this is not so easy precisely because, and this will be one of the themes of the talk, the limits as the large parameters go off to infinity don't commute. You have to understand joint scaling limits as all these things go to infinity, and we don't understand sort of what these scaling limits really are for neural networks. That's part of the fun of the problem. Okay, so much more about that in a moment. So the second kind of question that I'm interested in broadly is, you know, I want to understand feature learning. So I want to understand the adaptation of the learned function, f of x with theta learned, to the statistics of the training data. OK, I'll put a question mark there for no good reason. Right, so like half the time when people get excited about machine learning these days, they think about foundation models that are pre-trained on some big data set. And the reason we're excited by them is that somehow the learn setting of parameters extracts some meaningful features from the data, whatever that's supposed to mean. Most people don't have a very good definition of that. But this idea that we're doing nonlinear models in which we learn interesting basis functions that are supposed to extract meaningful information from the data is fundamental but poorly understood, especially in this regime where everything is allowed to be large, kind of as it is in practice. Okay, and let me say one final thing, okay, just to give you a sense. So I'm interested in understanding the alignment, so to speak, of the model and the data and the learning algorithm. So somehow, in practice, what we know is that if you choose a certain kind of neural network, you know, the structure of the model, I've written down here only the simplest possible neural network. This is not a transformer. This is just a vanilla fully connected thing. And you have certain kinds of data that align with the models, and certain kinds of optimization schemes, maybe Atom versus SGD, whatever. I want to understand how these three things play together. Yes, please.
You can tell me where the theta parameters are.
Yes, right. So theta is just a flattening of all these matrices W. So the way you think about it is somebody gives you the values of the NL and the capital L.
Matrix elements.
Yes, precisely, precisely. Those are trainable parameters of the model. And I just record them generically in the vector theta.
The structure of the network.
Right, correct. So the N's and the capital L and the nonlinearity sigma are usually called the architecture of the model, and you have to give that to me. And on a computer, I can optimize the values of these parameters.
Can set something to zero so it effectively can give you a subnet.
Yes, in principle, it could learn that, indeed, no doubt. That's right, that's right.
The biases are absorbed in your weights and stuff like that.
Yeah, okay, so indeed, everything I say is a lie, you know, except it's like a white lie, in the sense that, of course, in practice, people have biases, they also have many other things that they turn on. But like I'm after a like exactly solvable model.
Okay, so no biases
in my world. The question of whether I can do biases, I've actually never thought about because I wasn't that interested. But it's a reasonable. Okay. Yes. Yeah. So the graph is you start with an n0 dimensional vector, you hit it by an n1 by n0 matrix, then you apply your fixed nonlinear function sigma to every component, then you hit it.
Same nonlinear thing.
That's how they do it, the same nonlinear thing. Then, so that this is called one hidden layer. Then you do this again, you go from RN1 to RN2. You do this capital L times, and then finally you have a scalar readout.
I see. So all of the fan out is in the W's.
Yes, that's right.
These are just weights on the link.
Yes, that's precisely what it is. I just didn't want to draw all the
that's
links.
Like the only way to think about weights, the weights could be at the vertex.
That's true, but they're not in these neural networks. You know, I don't know what else to say. It's fair, but yes. Yeah, at least not, yeah, right, indeed, right. Please do interrupt me with questions or comments, okay? I'm just like trying to be more or less self-contained. Okay, so here's my like rough introduction to the kinds of questions I'm interested in. And let me tell you what this talk is gonna be about, and then I'm gonna draw some pictures and hopefully tell you some interesting theorems. Okay, so in this talk, I want to explain basically two things. I want to explain how we can exactly answer questions 1 through 3 in certain kinds of models of learning with neural networks. Okay, so I'm going to explain the answers to question 1 through 3 for the following setting. Okay, so let me write it down, then I'll explain why I care about this. So my nonlinearities are going to have the following form. They're going to look like the identity plus a coupling parameter times a cubic correction. So let me say it this way. This is a kind of what's called the generic shape nonlinearity. It comes by reshaping or rescaling a generic odd function that passes through 0 at 0. OK, so this looks kind of funny. In every single layer, I'm saying my nonlinearity is close to the identity. So you might say it's almost as if the sigmas are not there. But what happens is, actually, what's known is that if I want to study this as the number of layers grows, which is my goal, this is actually kind of the critical coupling you need. You need this 1 over L. That's like this amount of nonlinearity in each layer is what gives you order 1 amount of nonlinearity at the output. If you have more nonlinearity than this, you get kind of like ill-defined priors over your problem anyway.
May I ask you a question?
Yeah, of course.
It's probably better if you answered it at the end, but
yes?
I don't know. So. I know that you're extremely familiar with different forms of the universal approximation theorems, right?
Yes.
You've done your own works. So if you don't have biases, you probably, the universal approximation theorem probably does not work, correct?
I mean,
the form of the universal approximation theorem that I know also says that your nonlinear loss functions need to be non-polynomial loss functions, but your version...
No, but that's only with one layer. With an infinite number of layers, I'm telling you, you can get anything this way, modulo the bias issue.
Okay, and if you have a finite number of layers?
Well, so the short answer is I don't know what the necessary and sufficient conditions are at a fixed finite number. It's like, it's kind of an interesting question, but a little bit orthogonal in a sense.
No, so I'm just coming from, I want to understand if I can translate the results or how far I can go with translating the results of your work to my neural networks.
So okay.
So if you don't have biases and...
So the answer is not very far because you'll never implement Bayesian inference with your neural networks.
Yeah.
That's just the honest truth. So okay, this is meant to be a solvable model,
yeah.
Not one you can necessarily numerically do.
Yeah.
So just take as given that this is kind of like, this is the right way, at least if you're going to do odd activations, is scaling everything to get interesting order one answers. And this concept psi is like a number I get to vary. It records how strong my nonlinearity is. Okay, so this is the nonlinearity I'm going to take, and my algorithm that I'm going to study for learning is Bayesian inference, and I'll remind you a bit of what that is. And I'm going to do it at zero temperature, and I'll remind you what that means as well. So at zero temperature, I'm always going to assume that I have a situation in which the number of samples that I see is smaller than the dimension in which the samples live. So I'm guaranteed to be able to fit my training data exactly. That's kind of the natural thing to do when you're at zero temperature. Okay, and I'm always going to set the output dimension to be 1, which I have said a couple times now. So I'm always going to try to make scalar predictions. That's just the setting in which I'm going to put myself. Okay, and it's not just a simplicity thing. I actually don't know how to reproduce a lot of these results if n is not equal to 1. But okay, I hope you will forgive me. Okay, so here's my plan. So believe it or not, I want to spend some time talking about the case when psi is actually equal to 0. So you might say, get out of here. This is like, if psi is equal to 0, you just have a product of matrices. But actually, this case is already rather complicated and interesting and reveals a bunch of stuff, as I will try to explain. And then, so that's the first paper I wrote with Alexander. And then I'll tell you our very recent thing where psi is not equal to 0. And you get other kinds of understanding and interpretations of what's going on.
Is the signal, a function of the vector that's coming out?
Yes, yeah, sorry. So this is the kind of usual shorthand you take. So this sigma is a univariate function, but you just apply it separately to every component.
Sigma, this equation that you just write here has some index in it?
No. So this is the function you apply to each component of your vector separately.
Same function.
The same function to every component.
And t is what?
So, if you give me a scalar input, t, that's the thing I apply it to. I'm just saying to apply sigma to a vector, sigma applied to a vector v1 up to vn, is just by definition sigma of v1. Yeah, same one. And then I've just told you how to apply it to a scalar. That's the formula. Right, thank you. Okay, excellent. So, all right. So let me start, as I promised, with the case of psi equals 0. These are called deep linear networks, and people actually study them quite a bit because they're surprisingly complicated. And they have a lot of beautiful features. Okay, so let me now draw a picture and try to give you some intuition for why you might secretly care as physicists even about this case. And then I'll go to other things because this kind of stuff actually comes up in a lot of mathematical physics. Okay, so just to recapitulate, right, now my predictor looks very simple. It's just, okay, this is a vector at the end and then a product of matrices, WL down to W1 applied to X. And okay, because I have no nonlinearity here, the sigmas were all just the identity, I can just in fact write this if I want. I can contract this as theta transpose X. And I have a funny way of parametrizing my vector theta as a product of matrices. That's what I do. Okay, so let me draw a picture that I will try to keep up for quite a while because it's quite an important picture. Okay, so here I am in Rn0. And okay, what do I have? So I have in Rn0 the space of thetas that exactly fit the training data. X mu is y mu for every mu. Right? In this case, I'm just solving a system of linear equations if you give me my training data. Each input x, I just need to map to the correct output y. I get some hyperplane. Okay, let's say that here's the origin. Okay, very good. Okay, so now I'm going to start annotating this picture more and more. But let me get there for a moment. So how do you do this learning rule I'm alluding to, this Bayesian inference thing? Okay, well, Bayesian inference is exactly like Gibbs measures from statistical mechanics. And so you have to start with a prior. Okay, so my prior distribution looks like this. I say before I've seen any data, I think my parameter theta is going to be drawn from the prior that's defined in this way. And this prior is going to use the structure that I have on theta. So each of the matrix entries, W, L, I, J, are just Gaussian with mean 0, variance 1 over n L minus 1, independent of each other. OK, so if you did stochastic gradient descent, this is the way you initialize the parameters in your network before doing SGD. But here, when you do Bayesian inference, what you do is you say, I'm going to view that as a prior over my parameters. And then I'm going to have a likelihood, which I'll define in a moment, over the data, and I'll have a posterior. Okay, but let me just focus on this prior for 1 minute. Let me go over here. Can people see this thing? Okay. So let me draw my favorite picture. Okay, one of my three favorite pictures in life. So this prior is something that people actually think about quite a bit in random matrix theory and in certain parts of mathematical physics. And if you think about it, it's just a prior which is essentially given by a product of random matrices. Right? This kind of thing comes up all the time. And you can think of L down here, the number of matrices that you have. And let me just, for simplicity, assume that all of the n's, the sizes of these matrices, these nLs, are just proportional to a single large constant n. So I don't have to track them. Right? So there's two kind of classic regimes in which people study products of random matrices. One is the kind of Wigner style of random matrix theory, or the Wishart style, right, where you fix capital L. And you let the number, you let the size of the matrices grow. So this is what I would call like the free probability regime, okay, since I'm a mathematician. But this is all about maximum entropy distributions over the spectrum of these random matrices. And there are truly plus infinity papers written about this kind of style of random matrix theory. Okay, so that's kind of a beautiful thing. But there's another thing which is quite important in many branches of, okay, again, mathematical physics, which is you fix the size of the matrices and you let the number of terms in the product go to infinity. And this is like if you've ever done like Anderson localization in one dimension, when you have like transfer operators, each of these matrices could be like a transfer operator that you're applying. Okay, and this is like the world of ergodic theory. Okay, so there's also plus infinity kind of papers written about this regime. And the main point that I want to make, and this is what makes the prior interesting and not so trivial, is that if you just look at the simplest statistic of your prior, which is just the norm of this vector theta that you get under the prior, you get that the two limits don't commute. Okay, so just to save us some heartache, let me tell you the answer. If you fix the number of matrices you have and you let the size go to infinity, the norm of this parameter vector theta just converges to a constant. So if I normalize things correctly, it'll converge to 1 almost surely. Okay, so that's because these matrices preserve the size of the vector that I get. Very good. And over here, it's going to converge to 0. If you fix the size of the matrix, let the number of matrices go to infinity. So what I'm trying to say is that there are a lot of interesting questions about what happens in the middle. How do you interpolate between these two regimes? And the TLDR of a bunch of theorems I proved for nonlinear neural networks, but I specialize them here to the linear case, is the right way to interpolate between this regime where the width is much bigger than the depth and the depth is much bigger than the width is to study the ratio L over N being a constant, which I'll call the depth of the prior. So lambda prior over here equals 0. Lambda prior over here equals infinity. And I claim that everywhere in between, you basically have a one parameter family of theories for the prior, which depend on the limiting value of this ratio. That's kind of how the prior works. Okay, so lambda prior, the right way to think about it, at least the way I think about it, is it's basically the effective depth of the model under the prior. Okay, if L over N goes to 0, it's as if you had 0 hidden layers. That's the kind of thing that you're going to get. Okay, so that's my starting point. I have this prior over the matrices that I'm interested in, or over the vectors. And what you can see by the structure of the prior is, right, Gaussian matrices are rotationally invariant. So for example, this first matrix is rotationally invariant. And this means that if you kind of draw the equiprobable lines, the prior doesn't have any preferred directions. Okay, so this is my prior. And under the prior, you can just write theta is theta divided by the norm of theta times the norm of theta. And this thing is uniform. That's what I'm saying. And this thing is just the scale at which theta lives. Okay, that's just the structure of the problem that I'm studying. This is the prior distribution that you get. Okay, now how do you do learning? Well, to do learning, you have to give yourself a likelihood. So let me erase this thing and tell you about that, if I can find the eraser. Okay, so now here comes kind of my Gibbs measure.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just the different red curves here are representing different values of lambda.
The different...
You drew three circles, I'm just wondering.
Oh, sorry, so this is just saying that if you draw the density of the random variable theta, like the vector, these are like the equiprobable surfaces. I'm just saying it's rotationally invariant. Kind of like a Gaussian, but more complicated, roughly speaking. That's all I kind of mean by this. Yeah, thanks. Okay, so fine. So that's before any learning. I'm saying even before learning, because the model is nonlinear in its parameters, it's hard to describe the distribution you get. This is true even in the linear case. It's even more true in the nonlinear case. I'm like, okay, that's one of the things I know and love, but that's not the purpose mainly of the talk. Okay, so now let me describe the posterior, and this is where the learning is. And the posterior, just by definition, is what you get when you have a Gibbs measure, okay, at zero temperature. So the posterior distribution of theta, which depends on my data set and my model, is by definition like this. So I take my prior distribution of theta, which depends just on the model, has no data in it yet, and I weight it by e to the minus beta times my Hamiltonian L, okay, of theta, which depends on the data, which I'll write down in a second. And then you have a partition function, which the Bayesian people call the Bayesian model evidence. It's the probability of the data under the model. And then zero temperature means I take beta to infinity, right, where my loss L of theta, what did I write it as? Like this, is just by definition the mean squared error over my training data. Okay, you have f of x mu theta minus y mu squared. Okay, so what I'm saying is, you know, you believe before you see any data that this is a reasonable guess for how your parameters should behave. And then you have a likelihood function, which is just a Gaussian bump centered at the ways of fitting the data. This is like the minima of the Hamiltonian, right? This is where the loss is zero. And then because you take beta to infinity, all you're really doing is you're just taking this probability measure you started with, and you're restricting it to the space of ways of fitting your data. That's all there is. Okay, so let me write that down and then I'll stop for a second. So note, the posterior, you can just write if you don't care about the value of the partition function. It's just given as the prior restricted to the set where theta transpose x mu is equal to y mu for all mu. Okay, so you get some distribution, which is supported on this space of ways of fitting the data. And my goal, oh my god, is to understand this probability distribution if I don't run out of chalk before I finish writing. OK, that's what I mean by Bayesian inference. You start with a prior, you observe some data, and you'd like to understand the distribution after you've taken into account the data that you have. OK, very good. So. Let me write down one thing and then I'll stop. There's a simple structural observation about the prior, or about the posterior, excuse me. So if you draw theta from the posterior, then I claim it has a simple kind of characterization. Namely, you see in this picture, there's some basic linear algebra you can put in. So let me do it in this color. Let me do it in a color I haven't used yet, maybe this color. Okay, so there are these directions in the space, which are the span of the training data points that you've observed, the x mu's. And then there are the directions orthogonal to the span. This is the span of the x mu's perp. And this point over here is the way of fitting your data that has the smallest norm. I'll call it theta star, the minimal norm way of fitting the data, which is going to play a role in what we're going to do. And so the point now is, if you have any candidate vector theta, it makes sense to decompose it into theta parallel and theta perpendicular. Those are kind of the two directions that the problem knows about. And what you see is that because the posterior, because the posterior insists on fitting the data, what you know is that the parallel component of theta is the minimal norm interpolant. It has no other choice. But then you can always write the other component, the perpendicular component, as its direction times its magnitude. Okay, and the point is the following, that you see, the prior was completely rotationally invariant. And the likelihood, your Hamiltonian didn't care about the perpendicular direction, because that direction doesn't actually tell you how well you fit the data. And what that means is that even under the posterior, this thing is uniform on the sphere. It's a uniformly random vector. And so the only thing you can learn in this model is a scale. That's how this model works. There's a learned distribution over the scale. And this controls how big the predictions are in directions you haven't observed. That's kind of all there is in this problem. It's a rather simple-minded problem. Yes, please.
Sorry, I might not be getting this at all, but
yes.
The white line that's the set of the thetas that exactly interpolate.
Yes.
This has dimension like n naught minus p. It's like a big space.
Yes, correct. It's a hyperplane.
Right. And then these spans of the data are also hyperplane.
So this is a p-dimensional thing?
Yeah.
And I'm saying the whole space globally decomposes into this p-dimensional thing. And something which is parallel to the space of ways of fitting the data, the kernel of your data matrix.
But then, like, the intersection of the span of x mu with this
type. It's a single point. Wow. Well, because the whole space is n0 dimensional. This thing is p dimensional, and this thing is n0 minus p dimensional. So the dimensions work out. Yeah, right, indeed. Yeah, I can't draw a better picture due to the dimensionality, but I could have mentioned that, indeed. Okay, so I'm saying, like, this problem is not so terrible, but you see exactly what learning comes into. You say, look, I've observed a bunch of directions. I've observed all the x mu's, and I know what the answer is supposed to be. Now, someone gives you a new x, and the new x has some projection onto the directions you know, so you know how to make the prediction there, and has some projection onto the directions you don't know. And the kind of thing that you can do is you can learn the scale in the directions you haven't observed. You try to ask, given what I've seen about the y mu's and the directions I know, how should I predict the y in the direction I don't know? That's roughly how it works, okay? Very good. So let me now do this, just erase this thing. This is excellent. This will be the end of this part of the talk. Okay, so let me. Okay, it's okay. I'm just gonna do this. Okay, so without belaboring the point too much, this is okay. Believe it or not, I'm trying to point out that the model is pretty pedestrian. You have one scalar parameter you can learn in this model, but this is the first model. That's what this theorem I'm about to write down that we've ever found, in which you can have an exact formula for the posterior distribution after learning, that is non-asymptotic. You can take any value of the number of data points, the width, the depth of the model. All these things are completely arbitrary, and we can write down a formula. Okay, so this is kind of step zero in this paper I wrote with Alexander. So let me write as a mathematician would and write a theorem. Okay, so what do? We prove that kind of the decorated partition function, the partition function with a source, when you take the expectation of the posterior, and then you put in a source for your predictions at some new test point, x, you can write this non-asymptotically. Okay, so it's exactly computable. Exactly computable. So via what are called Meyer G functions. Okay, so you either love special functions, I think, or you hate them. But what I'm saying is, okay, when capital L was equal to 1, when you have just one layer in your network, like 99.37% of Bayesian inference in practice is based on the fact that if you had a model that's linear in your parameters, so L was equal to 0. Then the posterior is Gaussian. If you start with a Gaussian prior and a quadratic likelihood, you get a Gaussian posterior. That's like what Bayesian inference usually uses. And what I'm saying is, regardless of what L is, you can still get an exact form for the posterior. It's just not Gaussian. You have to know more special functions. Okay, I personally love special functions. If you're desperate, I can write down the answer, but it won't be ultra illuminating. There's just a bunch of contour integrals. That's how special functions work. So I don't know what to say, except that you can write it down exactly, and then you can start taking limits as the data set size and the model size go to infinity. You can ask what happens. So rather than writing the formula, let me show you the phase diagram that you end up getting. Okay, so I kept this phase diagram up here on purpose. If you want, this is a very baby phase diagram for what happens before any learning. And now I'm going to turn on learning and see what happens and what kind of models you can get. Okay, so in this phase diagram I'm about to draw, the number of samples, the widths of the network, and the depth are all going to go to infinity for me. And what I'm going to insist on, as before, is that p over n naught converges to some number that's less than 1. I'll call it alpha naught. So you always have more parameters than you did data points. You can always fit the data exactly. Okay, so let me draw the same kind of axes, L and N, which is just all my hidden layer widths are proportional to a large constant N. And what you find is that here there was a kind of interesting, I don't know if I should call it order parameter, I don't think I should, but there's just an interesting emergent notion of effective depth, this L over N. That's what came up and wasn't totally obvious. And it turns out that this is the effective depth of the prior, and there's a different notion of the effective depth of the posterior. Okay, so it turns out if you take L times P over N converges to what I'll call L lambda posterior. That's the effective depth of the posterior in the way I'm about to describe now. Effective depth of the posterior. So here's basically what happens. So up here, N is much, much bigger than all other parameters, much, much bigger than L, much, much bigger than P, in fact, much, much bigger than their product. So this is the regime where lambda posterior equals 0. And what you find here is that your model is the same. You get the same posterior as having 0 hidden layers. It's as if you started with a linear model to begin with. So although the number of hidden layers, capital L, might in fact be diverging, if it diverges slowly enough, you're not going to see the difference on the level of the model. Okay, so very good. Then what happens is you have a one parameter family of theories, which are parameterized by this value of lambda post. Lambda post. So over here, lambda post equals 0. And here, lambda post equals infinity. And the slightly, you know, unusual thing, we didn't know that this would be true before we did the calculation, is that everywhere along this curve, the posterior distribution that you get depends only on this value of lambda post and essentially the statistics of your training data. So the norm of the minimal norm interpolant and this constant alpha naught, which is recording how many directions I've actually seen. Okay, so it wasn't obvious, but hey, here's an interesting thing that determines the limiting theory. You get a nice one parameter family of posteriors you can write. But moreover, if you try to maximize the partition function or the Bayesian evidence with respect to this value of lambda post, you can never do it. From the Bayesian point of view, deeper networks are always better. That's what turns out. And so actually, believe it or not, this is, as far as I know, the first really principled example where you can say there's a mathematically well-defined sense in which deeper is always better. And deeper is really measured in terms of the effect of depth. That's how it goes. Okay, so notice that if L times P over N goes to a constant, then L over N had to go to 0. So it's a little weird, right? I used to have only L over N, and it's as if I blew up this corner of the diagram, and I had a whole new phase in there. So the question is, what happens over here? Well, don't worry, it survives. So there's a second phase of the phase diagram, which is kind of the strongly coupled phase. If you want, everything up here turns out to be weakly coupled in a sense. So over here, the relevant parameter is the L over N again. L over N is lambda pre, just like we had over there. And so here, lambda pre is equal to 0. Here, lambda pre is equal to infinity. And a kind of interesting thing happens. The posterior distribution you get is all of a sudden constant. it actually freezes to the optimal value. There's a unique distribution in this phase. There's a unique distribution period that maximizes the Bayesian evidence, that maximizes the free energy, if you want, of your system. And so here, the posterior, the predictions that you make don't care about the value of the prior depth that you have, but the evidence actually does. There's a unique lambda star which maximizes the evidence. So it's the argmax, excuse me for squeezing it in here, of the evidence. So there's a unique explicitly write-downable ratio for the depth over width to start with, which depends on your training data set, that gives you the simplest way of fitting the data. So you kind of get this like, okay, understanding that the phases are complicated even in this very simple model. Right? In the end, you're only learning something that's linear in the training data, but because your parameterization kept changing, you get rather different distributions over the space of interpolants. So that's kind of like what happens in the deep linear setting. Okay, let me stop for a second, because I want to tell you something about the nonlinear setting, but I feel like this is already kind of like a somewhat messy picture to interpret. Yes?
It reminds me a lot of double descent, because you also have several phase transitions in double descent, and one is I think data points over n, and one is, data points over number of parameters. And so the difference in your numbers is basically the width of a layer instead of the dimensionality of, so you have the dimensionality of the layer instead of the dimensionality of the data, but maybe it's related. And so what you see is phase transitions, and they also see phase transitions. So that tells me maybe this deinitialization caused the phase transition in the double descent regimes into these, but maybe I'm completely off.
So I understand what you're saying, but I think there's an important difference, which is here, at least from the Bayesian point of view, the Bayesian says, if I have many models which fit my data exactly, the way I'm going to choose the model is try to maximize the partition function. Yeah. And here, the partition function gets uniformly better. That's what happens.
Yeah.
So it's not so much a spike as like this gradual thing where deeper is just better.
Yeah.
That's essentially, so it's like, I don't know if they're related for this reason.
So I'm talking about something completely different. So I mean, double descent is a training phenomenon. And you did not, with gradient descent.
Yes, that's.
You did not do training, and you did not do gradient descent. So what I was suggesting is that maybe the initialization stage might already be responsible for the training procedure that comes later.
Potentially. So maybe let's take it offline in the sense that like there's something to say, but I don't think I can say it in a short way.
Okay.
Yeah. Please.
This might be a similar question, but so you have this like space of interpolance.
Yeah.
It's like something about the prior is enforcing that you end up with a minimum norm interpolant.
So it turns out that the minimum norm interpolant is always the mean of the posterior, but you don't collapse to a delta function around it. You just get different kind of variances. And maybe to answer your question, so what happens is if you had only one matrix, you know, and theta was just a Gaussian random vector, then all directions are equivalent. And changing the component in the theta star direction, or in the direction of the data, doesn't change the distribution I have over the orthogonal components. But what happens is, as you take more and more products in your matrix product, the components of theta become more and more correlated. And so fitting these components of theta has a bigger and bigger effect on the components you haven't seen. That's kind of how information seeps from the data into the directions that are orthogonal to the data. It's through the correlations induced by the prior. So I don't know if that answers the question you asked, but it answers a question which sounded related. Okay. Okay. So.
I lost track. What was the depth of the prior?
So depth of the prior is L over N.
Oh.
So somehow, when you don't have any data.
What's P there?
So here, P is the number of training data points.
Oh.
So the depth of the posterior is like P times the depth of the prior. It's like adding data is like the poor man's way of getting deeper. That's kind of, okay. That's don't quote me on that, so to speak. Although I'm being recorded, so yikes. But okay. So can you tell me how long does this go, just so that I can?
The lineup for food starts in half an hour.
Okay, wonderful. So I will not go half an hour. Okay, I'll go like 15 minutes maybe.
Food.
But this is food for the soul, Roger. Food for the soul. At least so I hope. Okay. So let me now switch gears. I told you about what happens with deep linear networks. And they were complicated enough, okay? Random matrix theory, especially with products, is a hard thing. But I want to say something about what happens in the nonlinear setting as well, because I'm very excited about that. And okay, so let me tell you what we know, or at least a little of what we know. Okay. Yet. So let me say something about the case of psi not equal to 0. So let me just remind you, since I've erased it. So you have a model, f of x and theta. And now I really do have the sigma in there. But because I insist on L being large, the sigma has a special form. Right? This is sigma times W1x. And the WLs are NL by NL minus 1. And sigma of T is T plus psi over L times T cubed. OK, that was my nonlinearity. Very good. So the first thing we learn when we analyze this model was, you see, here there was a proposal from the deep linear case about maybe how to understand the structure of the posterior, that this funny thing, the depth times the number of samples over the width, which has never appeared ever that I know of before, should control something about the posterior. Okay, and that turns out to be true even for the nonlinear case. Okay, so let me say it this way. So here's kind of result number one. I'll just tell you a couple things we learned. Okay, so suppose we're in the situation where we take the depth and the hidden layer widths and the number of samples to infinity. Okay, but you have LP over N goes to 0. Okay, but I'm in this nonlinear setting. So the linear setting would predict you're going to get something that had no hidden layers. So you're just going to get a linear model, literally linear in its parameters. And that's true here, but with a twist. Okay, so the theorem is then the model we're studying, the entire partition function that you get is equivalent. Actually, it's true at finite temperature too, but it doesn't really matter, to a linear model. Okay, with the following features. So it's a linear model, but actually it has a very non-trivial dependence on this parameter psi. So what you do is you start with an x, which remember was an input vector, and you have to take a nonlinear transform of it. So the transformation you take looks like this. It turns out to have the form e to the psi times 1 minus 2 psi norm x squared to the minus 1/2 times x. Oh my god. Okay, so this is a way of going from x's to some other x's. And what I claim is that after you extract these features from your x's, then you just do the usual kernel method that you want with this as the features. Okay, so I'm about to draw a picture of what this means in a second, but just notice that if I forget about some constants, I absorb some e to the psi's and some 2's and whatever, this roughly looks like 1 plus or minus the norm of x squared to the minus 1/2 times x, where the plus or minus comes from the sine of psi. Okay, that's the kind of data rescaling that you get. And I think one of the really cool consequences of this formula is that you get to understand what the role of psi actually is. Okay, so let me draw a picture. So I claim psi is actually implicitly determining for you the curvature of a manifold in which you think your data lives. It's kind of unusual, but that's how it works. So if you look at this particular way of going from a point in R and 0 back to a point in R and 0, let me draw it in a kind of funny manner. Okay, see if I can draw this picture in real time. So I claim it has an interpretation in one dimension higher. Okay, let me see if I can do this. All right. So here's my set of points. I'm going to embed everything into one dimension higher. So this is a hyperplane in Rn plus 1. Here's the point 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. And this is a hyperbola. Okay, this is the space of x0, x, such that x0 squared is equal to a norm of, or 1 minus norm of x squared. I want to say this, just like that. Plus, 1 plus. Sorry, I didn't get the normalization right. It's like this. Okay, it's a kind of standard hyperbola. And here's the point that I'm making. Okay, I'm not totally insane for drawing this picture. Okay, so if you take a point, let's say I take a point right here, 1, x, and here's the origin, and I take the usual mapping from this plane onto the hyperbola, what do I get? Well, I just rescale it by 1 minus x squared to the minus 1/2 times 1, x. And you see that if I just forget the first component, I get back here to this thing, which maybe I'll call x hat for no good reason. And you see, the norm of x squared can't be too big. Actually, you get a kind of hard cutoff in the input space. This thing needs to be, you know, okay, greater than 0. And this is reflected in the fact that when you project the hyperbola down to this plane in my normalization, you can only get the unit circle, unit disk, unit sphere, unit ball, whatever. Okay, so this is what happens when psi is positive. Psi, it turns out, when you undo the rescaling, controls the curvature of this hyperbola into which you embed the x's. Okay, when psi is negative, you get a kind of opposite picture. Okay, the picture is you embed everything into the upper hemisphere. Okay, so if you start with a point 1, x here, and again you connect it to the origin, and you map it onto the sphere, it's 1, x times 1 plus norm x squared to the minus 1/2. That's how the rescaling works. And so this corresponds to psi less than 0. Okay, so what I'm saying is the effect of this psi, at least in the regime where n is much bigger than all the other parameters in the problem, is it basically says it allows me to change the curvature of the manifold on which my data lives. Okay, psi equals 0 was the original deep linear case here. And if psi is positive, I go into kind of at the top sheet of a two-sheet hyperbola. And if psi is negative, I go onto the upper hemisphere. So that's kind of the geometry of what these shape nonlinearities are doing. And nobody knew that before. But OK, that's what you get by being a little obsessive. OK, so that's really cool. This is like piece of evidence number one, that maybe L times P over N is the effect of depth. Because I sent the depth to 0 and I got a kernel method. But I still got a one parameter family of kernel methods. And this is kind of a post hoc justification for this scaling. You know, psi shows up as an order one constant in the end that controls what's going on.
Sorry, I understand that depth, but what this other limit, n, you, sorry, L, n, L, p goes infinity.
I'm saying what you do is you take the depth of the network to infinity, the number of training data points to infinity, and the widths of the network and the input dimension all to infinity. But you do it in such a way that the depth times the number of samples over the width goes to 0. The width is just bigger than their product. And I'm saying, although the number of layers went to infinity, you still get a linear model. And this, for me, justifies calling this thing still an effective depth parameter. Okay, at least that's the start of the justification. It wasn't obvious that the model should be linear. It had lots of layers, after all. But OK, it doesn't care about what we hope and feel. So let me just write down maybe one more thing, and then I will stop. I'm happy to tell you more things about this model, as you can imagine, offline. OK, very good. So then what we did is we then did perturbation theory in 1 over n around this limit. And we found that the first order correction scales like L times P over n. OK, so and you get a truly nonlinear model. So let me tell you something about this nonlinear model. Okay, which thing do I want to tell you? Let me maybe tell you like this. So, this is the second result. So the first order correction, first order in 1 over n correction to this kernel regime, which I described, is cubic in the x hat variables, has an exact formula. And I can write it down for you exactly. OK, so let me write it. So f of x theta with parameter psi looks like this. So you get, let me write it this way. F of x and theta, okay, with psi equals 0, or sorry, let me not say it this way. Let me say at LP over n equals 0. That's the easier way to write it. So that's the thing I just described to you. It's whatever this kernel method gives you. And then you get an interesting correction. Okay, so the correction looks like this. There's an explicit constant which depends on psi. Then you get LP over N. And then let me write the correction and explain what the heck is going on. Okay, so the correction looks like this. You sum over all the training data that you have. So for each training data point, you ask, how much do I trust the prediction in that direction? And I'm going to write some symbols and then tell you what the symbols mean. Okay, so x hat transpose sigma hat x minus x mu hat transpose sigma hat x mu hat. Okay, where what the heck are these things? Where, so I start with my input x that I'm interested in, and I look at it in these new transformed variables that I call x hat. And what I do is I write the projection of x hat onto the direction spanned by my training data, and those are the coefficients a mu, first of all. A mu goes from 1 up to p. So that's what these a's are. The more I project onto some direction, the more I'm interested in the predictions from my training data set. Okay, and then this sigma hat is simply the empirical covariance matrix of the training data that I have. 1 up to p, x mu hat transpose. And so in words, what this is saying is the posterior you get at first order in this effective depth has a very simple deformation. It basically looks at all the training data points that you have, and it says, here's the prediction that that training data point would have given me on my new test point. And how much I either upvoted or downvoted depends on how well I align with the covariance matrix of the data that I've already observed. Okay, if this thing has a bigger projection onto the covariance matrix than the training data point has, I upvote it because I think it's kind of a bigger vector. If it has a smaller projection, I downvote it. That's how it works. Okay, so it's a formula that's like a little complicated, but let me just say there's no dot, 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 other than to say that this is big O of like n to the minus 2. You know, that's the dot, 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 but it's like an exact correction, the posterior that you get. And so we solve this to first order in LP over N, but I'm saying the perturbation theory we write down is in principle valid at any order. It just becomes more and more painful, and we don't know how to do it without like killing ourselves, basically. So we did it to first order, and we called it a day. So let me stop. There are other properties you can read off more or less directly from the partition function and the form of this posterior that you get. But I think you kind of get the idea. This model is nonlinear, so it's harder, but it's perturbatively solvable around small depth. And that's what we develop kind of in this latest paper, which we'll post soon. So let me stop, and I'll take questions or discussion, however you guys want it.
So this is asymptotic regime. This is perturbative corrections on that.
Yes.
Relevant to real-world architectures, or can this be tested on an architecture?
So it's complicated in the sense that, if you were to do like Monte Carlo to actually do the Bayesian inference numerically, it's like essentially impossible. You know, I'm telling you that the depth and the width and the number of data points, everything has to be quite large, and so.
So can you get in towards a scaling regime?
So we tried a little bit, and we just kind of like ran out of memory, so to speak. So the way I come at it is I say, look, people don't do Bayesian inference in practice when training neural networks, at least almost never. But I wanted any kind of analytic model in which I could have a hope of saying, what are the kind of high-level properties of this model? And I feel like I've learned that this LP over N is kind of useful, and I think I've learned something about the kind of behavior or like the dependence on the nonlinearity strength. And so the next thing I'm doing now is I'm actually trying to do the gradient descent version of this. You know, instead of taking the prior and doing the posterior, you take the prior and you optimize. And I suspect, but I'm not sure, that still this will be the effect of depth, and the effect of psi will be qualitatively similar. And then I could really test, once I have a formula for the perturbative correction to the like thing you learn, but I don't know what the formula is, so it's hard to, yeah. So I don't think that this is the answer for SGD. For sure, that can't be right. That'd be crazy. It could be, but it doesn't seem likely. So yeah. So ask me in 6 months. That's what I tell people. Maybe 9 months. Okay. Yes.
So at the very beginning, you talked about like aligning the learning rule.
Yes.
Data, and then now you have like based on nonlinearity, here's like a feature map. That's the thing you're talking about with the kernel regime.
Yes.
But then with this like this perturbative outcome, I guess, like, where is there, like, what kind of data is this feature map good for? Because for this, it seems like it just works for whatever your covariance matrix.
Yeah, so you're totally right. So what I did was I said, for any data set you give me, here's the form of the correction.
Yeah.
Okay. And I didn't tell you about how to maximize the evidence. We can classify for which data generating mechanisms this, including this correction, increases the evidence. That's how a Bayesian might answer your question. But you're really asking, when is this kind of correction going to do better in generalization error? And the short answer is, we have some examples of data generating processes for which this does better. But like, it's not always going to do better. I'm just saying this is the form of the answer. And whether this is good or bad for your data generating process, like, depends a little bit on how your data was generated, obviously. Yeah. So it's totally fair, but like, you kind of see the adaptivity to the training data. You know, you take a test point and you like compare it to all the training points you have in the sense of how well it aligns with the empirical, you know, you start to see this thing which neural networks are supposed to do, which is they do something nonlinear in the data generating process. And I'm saying, like, this is the first example I know how to write, like, with my bare hands.
Yeah, I was just thinking that classic picture where people are talking about, like, kernel methods, and they show, like, oh, you can classify, like, concentric circles because you map it.
Yes.
And I see this, and I'm like, maybe this is going to be suited for a specific, like, data sets that this will...
Yeah, so here's kind of a stupid example. But imagine that your true data generating process was the x's lie on some hyperbola. You start with some, like, 1, comma x's on the hyperbola. And your data generating process is you just you pick off just the last bits of it. You forget about the kind of x0 component. And you apply a linear model to that. So then having this, the value of psi, which actually matches the curvature of your hyperbola, is going to do better than having psi equals 0, in the sense that the norm of your, like, minimal norm interpolant is going to be smaller. That's like the precise sense in which it'll be better. But it's kind of tautological once you draw the picture. You know, I haven't told you anything beyond that, I think. Yeah.
Any questions online?
Yeah, I had a quick question. So you mentioned at the beginning of the talk that you don't know what happens when you set the output dimension to something larger than 1, right?
So now that you've seen the talk, the answer is I don't know what happens in the deep linear case when I have a complete characterization of everything. Here we can work out what happens when the output dimension is bigger than 1, although we didn't. But you can do it for this, like, perturbative thing. Yeah.
Okay. That's great.
Oh, okay, great.
Anyone else online? In person, going once? Okay, let's thank Boris again for a wonderful talk.